I'm Polly and I'm hosting today. First, I'll give you an overview of the morning's structure. The first hour will be a lecture by Ian Rees. If you think of questions you want to post during the lecture, you can post them via the chat function in the taskbar at the bottom of your screen during the talk. These questions will then be addressed in the discussion. Please would you mute yourselves during the lecture, but we would appreciate it if you'd leave your videos on to give more sense of an audience for Ian. After the lecture, we will have our coffee and cake break with the option of breakout rooms. The break will be approximately 20 minutes. After this, we'll go into our usual discussion in the round and plan to finish at 12:45. Please note that we are recording the first part of this morning, Ian's lecture, but not the discussion in the round. If you lose your connection during the lecture, please log back in using the Zoom link you received in your confirmation email. We will be checking the waiting room regularly and you will be readmitted. So please make sure you remain on mute. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Ian Rees. He's going to speak to us on Dennis Wheatley, The Devil Rides Out and the 87th Psalm, Demonization and the Making of Our Foundation in the Holy Mountain. Ian is a psycho-spiritual psychotherapist practicing in Glastonbury, Somerset. He has been a therapist for 30 years and spent 10 years before that working in probation work and social work at all levels, from field worker to manager to education advisor for mental health at national level. He is an experienced trainer and taught at the Karuna Institute in Devon from 1999 to 2009. He designed and ran their MA programs, as well as being central to the teaching team. Since 2009, he has concentrated on developing the Anun Foundation workshops and the Awen training, and presents this material in the UK and Israel. So now, over to you, Ian.
Thank you very much, Polly. It'd be great, yes, if everybody could turn their cameras on. It just helps me to have a sense that you're out there and I'm not just sitting here talking to my cats, really. The cats are quite a tough audience, actually, so I appreciate the sense of other people being with me in this. Over this very strange year we've been all living through, I've been reflecting quite a lot on the whole idea of otherness and this idea of demonization. And in a way, it seems to me there are two great tendencies in human life. There's a tendency to wish to include and the tendency to banish. And I've been thinking quite a lot about the implications of othering people and the difficult task of inclusion. I mean, the word inclusion is a very common word these days, used politically. Very commonly, the need to be inclusive, it's become one of the great virtues. And yet, it seems to me often that there isn't enough weight given to the genuine difficulties of inclusion. Or enough weight, perhaps, given to the desire to make other, to separate. Now, as I've been sort of contemplating these two tendencies, these issues, it's led me to two very, very different books. One is this book, Mysterium Conjunctius, Jung's last book, The Mystery of the Conjunction. And in a way, this book, the inspiration for this book arises in 1944. Where he has a vision. And I'll just read you the vision. You find it in Memories, Dreams and Reflections. So he says this: I myself was, so it seemed, in the Pades Riminon, the garden of pomegranates, and the wedding of Tifereth with Malchut was taking place. Or else I was Rabbi Shimeon Bar Yochai, whose wedding in the afterlife was being celebrated. It was the mystic marriage, as it appears in the Kabbalistic tradition. I cannot tell you how wonderful this was. I could only think continually, now this is the garden of pomegranates, now this is the marriage of Malkut and Tiferet. I don't know exactly what part I played in this. At bottom, it was I myself. I was the marriage. And my beatitude was that of a blissful wedding. Now, in the Stephen Koniunctius, he draws a great deal on the Kabbalah, and I've been talking quite a lot about the Kabbalah as this talk goes on. I've been studying it all my life, really. But I particularly like that vision of his. It contains so much, so we're going to unpack it a little. And in a way, the whole of the enormous two-volume work of Mysterium Conjunctius is his attempt to unpack the implications of that wedding. The other thing that Jung says around the Kabbalah that has always been interesting to me, really, is that in his 80th birthday interview, he says, the Hasidic Rabbi Badov from Meseritz, whom they called the Great Magid, anticipated my entire psychology in the 18th century. Now, the Hasidic movement, which is something that arises in Eastern Europe from the inspiration of somebody called the Baal Shem Tov in the 18th century, was an extraordinary social movement, really, that existed among the persecuted communities of Jewish Eastern Europe. And one of the extraordinary things they did was to take the metaphysical doctrines of the Kabbalah and to psychologize them, to make them relevant to the lives and the day-to-day experience of people living under quite difficult circumstances. And one of the key things that they did in this process was to look at the whole nature of evil. And they created a model in which the way to deal with evil is not to banish it, but to embrace it. And there's a whole tradition talked about the elevation of strange thoughts, the binding of evil back into the bundle of the living. Now, So as I say, one of my inquiries just took me in that whole direction, which I'll come back to. The other perhaps most surprising place it took me to is into a very, very, very different book. This, which is The Devil Rides Out, a little Arrow paperback published in 1964. And it's written by Dennis Wheatley, who at that time was a very, very, very successful author. And it's a kind of lurid story about a black magician who is trying to create a world war by inviting the power of evil powerfully into the world. And it's about how in this book he gets stopped. It's interestingly, the original edition of the book is written in 1934, so before the Second World War, and but in that period in the 30s where people were getting very worried about the World War. And I guess Wheatley, who always was a writer who wrote on the zeitgeist, was taking some of these images and ideas and working with them. Now, at the heart of Wheatley's book is a marvelously named figure called the Duc de Richelieu. I mean, Wheatley's characters, he was actually quite a right-wing author. He was a wine merchant who moving in quite exalted circles. And so his heroes are always extremely posh and slightly exotic. And the Duc de Richelieu, who is one of his major heroes in many of his books, is a sort of French aristocrat, descendant from the Cardinal de Richelieu, whom we may know from the Three Musketeers. But in this book, the Duc de Richelieu is a white magician. He's in a sense a type of Kabbalist, what the Hasidic teachers would have called a zaddik. And I mean, I came across this book really in 1967, the Archetypal Summer of Love. You know, obviously a time when Carnaby Street, when Haight-Ashbury, when San Francisco is full on exploring all kinds of ideas and all kinds of new excitements. I, however, was exploring this in Greycavern Park in the Swansea Valley, where the summer of love was probably not very evident, other than my abilities to be able to listen on what I then called my tranny, which at that time is not a statement of sexual identity, but a little box you used to carry around, which you would tune to pirate radio stations. And then in 1967, the emergence of Radio One. So my connection, in a sense, to the summer of love was partly through listening to my transistor radio, but also through these strange little books. I mean, Dennis Wheatley writes then a whole series of books that have these very exciting black magic themes. Now, one of the things I particularly liked in Devil Rides Out is the Duc de Richelieu is constantly going around exorcising things, banishing the demands of the evil magician. And he uses a very evocative phrase, which has stayed with me for many years, well, up until now, really. And it's very dramatic. It's fundamenta eius in montibus sanctis. And when you shout that, evil vanishes and runs away, which is kind of quite handy, really. But the interesting thing, really, about this quite lurid novel, which involves involves the invocation of the angel of death and the and the chanting of a mysterious and quite fictitious ritual called the Dread Susuma ritual, which sort of banishes evil. The interesting thing about these acts of banishment is that they don't work. The black magician keeps on coming back. The black magician is called MacArthur, and he's really modelled on Aleister Crowley, who was a sort of a Kabbalist magician at the time of Dennis Wheatley, and whom had the reputation at that time for being the wickedest man in the world. But anyway, so MacArthur has this image, or MacArthur is modelled on this image of Aleister Crowley. And what happens in the book, these acts of banishment don't really work. And the black magician, in fact, steals a young virgin girl called Fleur, who is the daughter of one of de Richelieu's friends, and spirits her off to a ruined monastery in Greece, northern Greece, and is there about to perform the black mass by sacrificing the little girl that will bring about the apocalypse. And as part of this, he invokes the demon goat of Mendes. Now, the way the book comes to a conclusion is not to all the derring do of Duc de Richelieu and his friends, but by the mother of the girl, who's a woman called Marie-Lou. And Marie-Lou has a dream in which she finds herself she finds that she has an iron circlet upon her forehead in her dream, and she is reading a magical book called the Red Book of Appin. And the Red Book of Appin is a book that exists in folklore. Wheatley didn't make it up. And it's a book of fairy magic. And so in the denouement, really, of this whole book, they're in the ruined monastery. The demon goat of Mendes has appeared. MacArthur is about to give the goat a thing called the Talisman of Set, and then he's about to sacrifice the little girl. Duc de Richelieu has done various things to try and stop this and can't. Now, the actual conclusion happens because Marie-Lou suddenly remembers her dream. And as she remembers her dream, she says this phrase that runs like this: to those who love without desire, only to they will power be granted at the darkest hour. And then she speaks a mysterious word. And what then happens is the is everything then just stops. And then around the figure of Fleur, who's this little girl sort of paralyzed on an altar, this figure emerges that is neither male nor female, neither from the east or the west, sort of an androgyny, who is described as a being of light, and who, in the face of the light and the radiance of this being, Makarta is overthrown, the goat of Mendes ceases to exist, and all is made well. Now, what's interesting for me, what has always interested me about this ending, is that most of the book is actually taken up with a lot of very dramatic activities, car chases, and grenades are thrown, and there's a very dramatic bit in the middle where there's a magic circle and the demons are trying to pierce the magic circle and are constantly being thrown out. But the actual conclusion, the successful conclusion, depends upon the mother, who is, in a way, this very passive figure throughout the whole thing, listening to her dream, acting upon her dream, and then we have this impossible phrase, to love without desire. Now, for her to love without desire, it actually, in these circumstances, is the conjunction of almost, it's like an impossible conjunction. To love, yes, but your daughter is about to sacrifice. How can you not desire? How can that not be present? And then an interesting phrase that follows it. She speaks a word of five syllables. Now, in the Christian Kabbalah, the word of five syllables is a word called Yeshua, Yud He Shin Vav He, and it's the word that represents the archetypal human being, the human being who brings opposites together. It's called Adam Kadmon in the Kabbalah. And what we see arising out of this, and the conclusion of this very dramatic story, I mean, in a way, quite an anticlimax, because what happens is, out of the young girl, who is the most vulnerable figure, who is who personifies innocence, this figure emerges that unites all the opposites and brings things to a conclusion. Now, the images that Wheatley is using in much of the story come right out of the heart of Judeo-Christian tradition. The goat of Mendes, the witch's sabbat, the idea that there are people dedicated to darkness who are not like the rest of us and who are plotting, continually plotting. We see it in our time. We get these various satanic moral panics, where in the 80s and 90s in particular, there was a whole thing in both here and in America of children being taken into care because people believed that their parents were Satanists. Now, that image of the goat of Mendes, the image of the people who are evil, has roots deep in collective history. The original, if we go right back into the history of Judaism, what we find is that there's a powerful custom that happened at Yom Kippur, which is the time, Yom Kippur in Judaism is the time of the renewal of life, but it's also the time of the confession of sins. Now, in early Israelite tradition, one of the things that would happen in Jerusalem at that time is that there would be two goats, one that is the goat that is given to God, and then the goat that is driven out into the wilderness and thrown into a great ravine, bearing all the sins of the people of Israel. And so this image of driving out, of driving the devilish thing away and throwing it into a great abyss, has very, very ancient roots inside our psyche. But of course, there is an enormous cost, in a sense, of continually having to do that. So both within our psyche and within our world. Because, of course, the the energies of life that keep on regenerating. Indeed, interestingly, in Wheatley's novel, the black magician keeps on returning. So the continual casting out of him doesn't take him away until something different emerges that can include opposites. And in a way, what Jung is talking about when he expresses so powerfully, you know, I'll just read again this vision, because it's a brief thing, but it's very easy to kind of disregard the power of it. I myself was, so it seemed, in the Pardes of Riminon, the garden of pomegranates, and the wedding of Tiferet with Malchut was taking place. Or else I was Rabbi Shimon Ber Yochai, whose wedding in the afterlife was being celebrated. It was the mystic marriage, as it appears in the Kabbalistic tradition. I cannot tell you how wonderful it was. I could only think continually, now this is the garden of pomegranates. Now this is the marriage of Malchut with Tiferet. I do not know exactly what part I played in this. At bottom, it was I myself. I was the marriage, and my beatitude was that of a blissful wedding. Now, this is the opposite, really. This is the opposite of driving out. This is the coming together of things. And strangely, in the this exorcism phrase, really, that we find Dennis Wheatley using, Fundamenta eius in montibus sanctis, is actually the beginning of the 87th Psalm. And the 87th Psalm has strong resonances within the Kabbalah, and actually is much more related to the idea of bringing things together and to the idea of the Tzaddik who embraces the impure, the evil, the disturbed. So I'll just read, I mean, it's actually quite a short psalm, and it may sound even a bit meaningless, really, because its content is slight, but I'll just read it so you have it. By the sons of Korah, a psalm, a song. He makes his foundation in the holy mountain. Yod-Heh Vav-Heh loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwelling places of Jacob. Glorious things are said of you, city of God, Selah. I mention Rahab and Babylon to those who know me. Behold Philistia and Tyre with Cush. This one was born there. But of Zion it is said, a man and a man, Esh va'esh, was born in her, and he, El Elyon, established her. Yod-Heh Vav-Heh takes account when he writes down peoples. This one was born there, Selah. Singers and dancers, all my springs are in you. Now, that beginning phrase, the Fundamenta Eos in Montibus Sanctis, this making the foundation in the holy mountain. Now, the word for foundation in Hebrew is yesod. It is also a sphere of the tree of life. And when Jung talks about Tiferet and Malchut, he's describing aspects of the Hebrew tree of life. Malchut is the place of the body, the place of earth, the place that's called the living kingdom. Tiferet is the place of the soul. Yesod, the foundation, is the place of conjunction, the place where the soul and the body come together. And the cities that are named in the psalm are the opponents of Israel. They represent the places that are far from the mountain of holiness. And so what this psalm is describing is the place where you become this figure called the Tzaddik. You become the one who is aligned with the sense of verticality that the holy mountain describes, and that you start and you become the conjunctive person. Now, in the psalm, it talks about those who are born from in the cities of the plains, the cities who are not aligned with the holy mountain, but and it says they are born there. In relation to those who are born in Zion, there is a phrase of a human being and a human being is born there. Aish va'aish. Now, the word Aish in Hebrew, it means human being. It's also related to the word Ash, which is represents fire. So the so one of the images that, that you have in ancient Hebrew tradition about the human being is that they are souls of fire, the Ashim. And the phrase Aish for Aish suggests a doubled person. The letter Vav, which is the conjunctive letter, represents the idea of the joining together of things. So if you're going to align, with the Holy Mountain, align with that kind of deeper territory of the soul, in order to be recognized as one who is able and living in that place, you become a doubled person. A person, in a sense, who is in dialogue with the soul and who can bring together in the place of Yesod the difficult conjunction of opposites. In a certain sense, you know, if we think of the solidity of the body, the concreteness of matter, and the bringing of that together with the sense of the inspiration of the soul, and the meeting point of that at this place called Yesod, which is also the is also in itself an aspect of the soul, but the Kabbalists call this place the Nefesh, the conditioned soul. Now, the part of the psalm that talks about the gates of Zion, in order to become Aish for Aish, you have to be admitted through the gates of Zion, which means the ability to penetrate the self-referential aspects of our own mind and heart and be able to listen to the deeper promptings of the soul. This is where we find Jung at the beginning of the Black Books, the beginning of the Red Book, where he goes into the desert to invite the soul. It invites the descent of the soul into the conjunctive place where these opposites can start to come together. Now, in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, that this conjunctive plate of Yesod is also linked to two other spheres, one that represents the mind, one that represents the feelings. And one of the things that are referenced, particularly by the Hasidic teachers, is the constant internal dialogue that happens between our the sense of our foundation of who we are, in a sense our image of ourself, our conjoined image of self and conjoined image of world, with our everyday thinking and feeling. And the way in which that the way in which our inner dialogue can either continually recreate a past version of ourselves in order to provide ourselves with stability, or can be open to the more mysterious promptings, both of the world through the senses of the body and through the internal experience, through intuition of the voice of the deeper soul. So what is being referenced in a way in this psalm that Wheatley includes in this book, with apparently a very different message, is a Kabbalistic, very old Kabbalistic tradition, really, that is about becoming present to yourself, becoming present to your own inner dialogue, noticing the things that open the gates of Zion, that open the gateway to the intuition or close the gateway of the intuition. And having acquired the capacity to open the gates of the intuition, we become the doubled person, Aish v'Aish, who then has access to the deeper aspects of the holy city, the place where, and really the place of the temple, the place where the presence of the divine can be found. And what we find in this psalm is a description really of singing and dancing and the idea of a spring of sweet water. And the connection really that is made by in becoming Aish for Aish is somebody then who then is refreshed from inside, who can express the temple service, the singing and dancing that's really to do with the sacred singing, the sacred dances of the temple. And the thing above all that you find in the temple service of Jerusalem is the key thing that would emerge out of the temple, particularly at Yom Kippur, is the Kohanic blessing. which is the whole process of inviting the kind of the presence of the divine into the world, into human experience, to bless all that it touches. May the Lord bless you. May the Lord raise up his face to shine upon you. May the Lord grant you peace. So that this very, very ancient blessing is what we're given access to if we become Aishva Aish. And the task above all that the person that is given to the person who can do this is to stoop down into the abyss, into the place where things have become broken, where things have become lost, and to gather these aspects of ourselves, aspects of the world, and bring them back into what they describe as the great bundle of the living. Now, this is a way of looking really at opposites in a way that is entirely different from the idea of drive them out. You know, in a way, it's a sort of and it involves a certain amount of courage and kind of capacity of heart, really. So it's to first of all to look into yourself, to become present in yourself, to confront the shadows, the aspects of ourselves that we don't like. And you know, one of Jung's great abilities really was to understand that the way we discover our own shadow, our own exile places, is to look in the direction of those we hate. And God knows, in this last year, there's been plenty, certainly in my shadow territory, there's been plenty of opportunities to hate and plenty of opportunities to regard people as stupid. Now, it's interesting, the whole idea of hate, I think, sometimes, the whole idea of the shadow. Because in my own psyche and in my own survival of my childhood, the thing that was most important for me was to be intelligent, to do well at school, to get away from my family home, my family conditions, and to use education as the way to do that. So, in order to do that, I had not to be stupid. Above all, I could be many things, but to be stupid was the most dangerous thing. So one of the things the immediate thoughts that comes to me when I look at the things that some of the things that have happened, certainly in this past year, is I think how stupid people are. Individuals or masses, that's my immediate place, because that so much lives in my shadow. It's a very powerful bit of towards the end of the Red Book, really, where Philemon is teaching Jung to be a magician. And he says that in order to be a great magician, you must be stupid. And it's incredibly challenging thing. But I imagine it was challenging for Jung, because his mind is such an important part of him. But it certainly was incredibly challenging for me to read this. Because, of course, it is a direct confrontation with a powerful part of my own shadow. And when I think about, and I'm making no political point, this is just a personal thing, when I think about people voting for Boris Johnson and think how stupid people are, that's my shadow, you know, my absolute shadow being shown, because my own terror of stupidity, my own inability to let myself be stupid, is something I have to continually work on. And stupidity is a sort of interesting thing in a way, because actually there is a simplicity about stupidity. It's the Homer Simpson moment, it's duh. And if I let myself be stupid, and I can't easily do that, so I certainly can't do it very long. Actually, what happens is I get a bit more peaceful, I get a bit less agitated, and come more into my body. A lot more I could say about that, but you know, but the whole point about this process of not driving out is that of course when we drive out, we can do terrible things when we drive out. If you look at the Bosnian War, for example, where neighbours were murdering neighbours in the most heinous kind of way. You can look at any of the kind of probably all wars, actually, thinking about it. So there's obviously an enormous cost to all of us in the doing of that. But also there's the sense of violence that happens when we drive out aspects of ourselves, when we drive them out into the desert. We close ourselves in, we stop ourselves from understanding aspects of our own life. It's interesting for me just to think sometimes, well, what have I missed by not letting myself be stupid, by being clever? And part of what I've missed in that is a certain sense of innocence, I think. The need always to understand, in some ways, inhibits a deeper understanding. So as I work more upon my own stupidity, and don't get so horrified by it, something gets reclaimed in me. I mean, when I was very young, in my teens in particular, when I was very insecure and all kinds of things, like we all are in our teens, one of the things I couldn't bear was not knowing things. So if somebody said something I didn't know, I'd always to pretend I knew it, because it was so threatening not to know things. There's all kinds of reasons why that I needed to do that for my family, in terms of my family and very sinister and obscure dynamics, really. But that's the sort of thing that I think that the feel like the sending away of our shadow can do. So it, in this instance, makes me into a liar, and I then have to kind of justify that to myself, which sends a little bit more of me away. So when Jung talks about Stephen Conjunctus is his last book, and it takes him 10 years to write it, and I can't really understand why that is so, because we're talking about, because if we stop this process, historic process of sending things away, and start to embrace the lost aspects of ourselves, We start in a way to do something very hard. Poles of a magnet that repel each other. It's like we're then having to push two things together that don't want to come, because in the development of our psyche, we have separated, we have put things behind us. Now, the word shadow is such a brilliant, brilliant image, I think, really. Because actually, if you try and... you might remember as a child, sometimes I remember trying to see my shadow. And you do the thing where you kind of jump around and you try to catch it. And what you only ever do is catch a little glimpse of it. But if you're behind a light source, your shadow is before you. And of course, you find the shadow in your perceptions, in your projections, in your sense of what is other, what makes me angry, what do I wish to send far away from me. And of course, having created, what we do, of course, in our growing up, is we create a sense of self that is conjoined with a sense of world that we can bear to live in. And we all have to do this. We all have our own particular senses of wounding or accommodation we have to make with the world. And then, having created that sense, this foundation, this yesod, really, in the depth of our psyche, we have a whole set of processes and patterns that are about keeping it stable. It's the story I tell myself about myself, and the story I tell myself about me in the world. And in a way, the power of that, the difficulty of that story, is it doesn't feel like a story, it just feels real. Because in a certain sense, what we have to do if we're going to explore this territory is turn ourselves face inwards towards ourselves. and to discover the what we do discover, if we can bear to do this and can sustain ourselves in this place, is that what we consider to be me, what is Ian, is a constantly moving internal dialogue, repeating the things I believe to be true and pushing away the things that I believe to not be true. Now, that tendency in human life, through of course the current technology and in particular social media, has gained enormous traction, because we can very easily live in bubble worlds where people just tell us that we're right and don't disturb us. Or we can occasionally go off on quests to challenge evildoers on the net and get into arguments with people of different persuasions, and then retreat from them, having convinced ourselves that yes, they were as evil as we thought they were, and so we're not going to bother with them. We'll go back and talk with the nice people again. Now, the whole idea, really, that they find in the Kabbalah of being Aish for Aish, and what the Hasidic teachers would call being a Zaddik, is to first of all become present to Malchut, which is the body, to be orientated to the place of the soul, which is Tiferet, and to look at the conjunctive place, the place where we have established sets of opposites in comfort. And as we pay attention to that, in alchemy, this is the place really where you need the alchemical vessel, but the Kabbalists would talk about the vessel of the body. Because as you engage with the body, as you engage with being present with your senses, as you start to inquire into the constant internal dialogue, you start to disrupt the effects of your history. In a sense, one of the ways of understanding the alchemical process, the alchemical fire, in a certain way, is a particular kind of attention, where we are getting present with ourselves, present with what emerges in the psyche, and increasingly engaging with that with awareness, with listening to the thoughts and the feelings and the images that emerge within us. And instead of separating, starting to include, starting to get curious. So curiosity is one of the great virtues here, really. It's as we start to become curious into what emerges, what arises to meet us when we turn our attention inwards, we start to desegregate. The first step, and Jung talks about this in the subtext of Mr. Ivan Conjunctius, is an inquiry into the separation and the synthesis of psychic opposites in alchemy. So the very first thing that starts to happen as we start to pay attention into this place, Kiliasod, into the, if you like, our natural but constructed psyche, we start to discover a sense of separation. We discover incompatibilities. In my case, for example, I start to notice how much I hate stupid people. And then if I then get interested in that hate rather than just letting myself do it, I then start to understand my fear of stupidity. And then start to experience stupidity as not something that's just out there, that also starts to live in me. Now, that disturbs me, of course. But if I continue to listen to that, continue to inquire into that, in a certain sense, the gates of Zion start to open, and I can start to listen to the voice of my intuition, which can start to help me with the difficult task of synthesis. Now, what that starts to do as well, so it's partly it starts to give me a bit more space in my own psyche. Actually, it's a really, you know, the idea of if I start to embrace my stupidity a bit more, and I get less scared of it, I even get a bit interested in it, and sort of, you know, what would that mean? What would a stupid Ian look like? this still disturbs me. I'm not at peace with this, and I'm not sure with these opposites. It's not really our function to be at peace with them. So we're not, what we don't want is premature resolution. Because one of the things that you find, one of the infuriating things about the whole alchemical process, which he describes in there, is you keep on having to, this process of separation and conjunction keep happening and keep happening. And the one of the big problems in some ways in some approaches to spirituality is a premature synthesis. Rather than, because actually the process of engaging in this way requires a continual process of separation, discovery, making some kind of peace, but then going right back again into the maelstrom, to discover deeper and deeper layers of a, if you like, a historical conjunction which separates the world into the good and the bad. Whereas this is an act of inclusion which deals with opposites as all part of the great bundle of the living, and works with the dynamism of opposites that enables, if I work with intelligence and stupidity, something interesting starts to happen. My cleverness starts to diminish. My actual intelligence starts to become a little bit more physical. Maybe a bit more in touch with things I might not look at. Now, one of the things I liked best about the Hasidic idea of the Tzaddik. Now, the word Tzaddik begins with the Hebrew letter Tzadi, which is the word, and it's a letter that has it's a bent letter. And in the sort of ideas around the Tzaddik, they say that the letter is bent because the Tzaddik is always bending down. Now, he's bending down partly because he or she is bending down into the abyss to gather the lost sparks, but also bending down as an act of humility, as an act of kind of surrender. Because one of the things that is most devastating, I think, in terms of this whole process of separation and demonization is the desire to be the perfect human being. The desire to be the person in whom there is no sin. Because one of the great images that you get from the great Magid and his teacher before him, the Baal Shem Tov, and then Baal Shem Tov's grandson, Rabbi Nachman of Breslau, they talk about the Tzaddik as possessing all the sins of human life. And that a great tzaddik is a being who finds all human sin within their own psyche. Now, it's an astonishing idea, really. I mean, if you think of that, since and in a way, it's quite a challenge to the ideas of what we might call a static perfection, where we just get rid of everything that is flawed. In a way, it's you know, the whole thrust of our society through medicine, through cosmetic surgery, through advertising, is to become the perfect person. You know, and whatever that perfect person is in this, you know, if you're a woman, you need to be impossibly thin. And you have to be, I guess in these days, you have to be strong and independent and an incredibly good, you have to be perfect. So you have to be able to do everything that is around womanhood in a completely perfect way. Similarly for masculinity, you have to be the kind of, you know, God forbid you should put on weight. One of the great shadow things of those of us like me, as you can see, we were a bit overweight. It's one of the great secular sins. As you get older, and as I've got older, I've periodically needed to visit the doctor. I can guarantee the first thing he will always say to me, in almost any circumstances, is you need to lose weight. You are a sinful and imperfect person, which of course I am. But That whole thrust of being sinless in our society now has become secularized, of course, because we don't live in a kind of religious society now. But it's the same impulse, right? It's the same impulse to carve yourself off out of the living material of your life into some static state of perfection, which you must then maintain at all costs. You know, when you see men and women who've had a lot of cosmetic surgery, I mean, it's so freaky. I mean, I find it very freaky because there's a sort of absence of expression. The thing about facelifts in particular, I mean, they're so awful because they erase a life. You see these extraordinary Botoxed faces that don't move and that have a horrible simulacrum of what a young face would look like. Rather than the beauty of a face with lines, with wrinkles, with grey hairs, with, you know, that's lived a life. And so I think this whole kind of territory somewhere where we are continually driving things away, where we're exiling the goat and trying to make ourselves into the shape that will be accepted, into the shape that will be holy, is a great perversion somewhere. And so when I come to consider this idea that to be a great tzaddik would be to bow down, to be humble, to be softened in that. In my case, it would really involve being stupid, and to bow down, to look into the places that have been lost and sent away. And then to have the courage to try and gather these things back into the heart. Now, if I think about what that practically can mean for me, it would mean I would have to gather Donald Trump into my heart. Now, that for me is a challenge, I have to be honest with you. I've been so loving the fact that he's no longer, that he can't tweet anymore, and effectively he's been banished. So there's a whole part of me that loves that. The fact that I don't turn on the TV every morning and have to react to something, or not have to react, I do react to something he's saying, is a great blessing. But sadly, it's that part of me that wants to send the goat away. And if I invite in, if I recognize, as I suppose I am now as I'm talking about it, that Donald Trump still exists, I guess he's in Mar-a-Lago and talking to whoever he can talk to. If I start to admit him back into my world, first of all, there's a sort of repulsion, I don't really want that. But then I remember that he is also part of the great bundle of the living. Now, sometimes in my life, I have done a lot of things in my life, and one of the things, the threads of my life, has often involved working with people who have done terrible things. And I've often had to work out, well, how can I be in the room with somebody who's done a terrible thing and remember that they're human? Particularly if they've done terrible things to small children. And certainly some of them have. The first step I have to make in this act of inclusion is first of all just sitting there, letting myself be there, and it's a bit like Donald Trump. I have to remember that Donald Trump exists. So that's my first step somewhere. I have to include, I have to recognize we are all part of the great bundle of the living. My perception of them, they might be a stinky, nasty, horrible bit of the bundle of the living that I don't want to near me. But at least if I recognize they're there, that's, I suppose, the first step. But certainly when in some of the situations I've been in, it has been required of me that I actually enter into relationship and also try and help the people who have done these awful things. And that has always been much more challenging and but the thing that I have come to in myself that just helps me, it's not a solution, it's just a crutch, it's an aid that just helps me kind of work with my own tendencies to demonize. is to remember that I don't believe in evil babies. I believe in traumatized babies, I believe in angry babies, I believe in babies who are so neglected that they find it impossible to relate, and therefore lots of things can come of that. But I cannot bring myself to believe in the idea of an evil baby. And so whenever I'm in front of somebody whom I find it really struggling with and finding it really difficult to difficult to accept the fact of their existence, really, I have to remember that I don't believe in evil babies. And that gives me a bit of a purchase to create, and it creates a bit of space, and within that bit of space I start to come back to myself, because a particular problem of demonization is that I lose the fullness of the other, but I also lose myself, because I sort of go out of myself into the part of myself that just wants to reject, just wants to push away. I lose all the other aspects of myself. So as I start to remember that I don't believe in evil babies, I start to remember myself. So the gift, in a way, of not demonizing is, in the act of demonization, you have also demonized something of yourself. You've given yourself away. You become effectively the killer. You are also the murderer. That's part of what happens in demonization. So in the process of discovering that I don't believe in evil babies, I come back to myself. I also start to be able to understand. I get some sense. I come into my body. I have some sense of the way in which my own internal dialogue is shaping itself. And as that starts to happen, and as I become aware of that as a dialogue rather than as a truth, then the gates of Zion start to open. Then I start to become Aish v'Aish. I become the conjunctive person. The other phrase the Hasidic teachers had about the Tzaddik is the Tzaddik is the conjunctive person who connects everything up together, connects the divine with the human, connects the divine with the demonic, who can include all possibilities of sin inside him or herself, and therefore can start to discover relationship and the path to transformation in so doing. Now this, I think, is what is it's all there in that little condensed vision of Jung, and it's certainly laid out in enormous and sort of wonderful, sometimes too much detail, because it's a heavy book of a mystery of Jungianness. But his work right at the end of his life really brings us right into this territory, and in some ways it sums together everything else that he's been looking at. And of course it's as relevant today as it was in 1954, when he finished writing it. In fact, probably more relevant because of the ways in which these energies of demonization and have accelerated, particularly during COVID. Then one extraordinary thing that got me really, my stupidity thing, was when that enormous ship got locked in the Suez Canal. There were things on the internet about people believing that there were lots of trafficked children inside that ship that Hillary Clinton had put there, because she's part of the worldwide satanic conspiracy. And there's a sort of, it's just an absurd, ridiculous kind of thing somewhere. And of course, the problem with even me saying that is I of course it's not true, but my dismissal of the people and the beliefs that come from there is another aspect of my capacity to demonize. So the continual difficult problem, really, that Jung looks at is this: the bringing together of things that belong together just because they exist. So if I show you these two books, depending on your interests, you're likely to be more drawn to one than the other. They look different; they're completely different in their content, and yet in some ways they're both addressing the same territory in their own particular extraordinary kind of way. So I think we're just about the end of our time now, but I think the image I just want to leave you with, right, is the image of the human being who is made human through their capacity to embrace, their capacity to be clumsy, their capacity to be stupid, the capacity to know that parts of themselves. Because as we know, the interesting thing, I think, that happens as we do that, our heart opens, as we become less cold, less rejecting of both of ourselves and of the world. And what you get then is a sort of a kind of radical innocence that emerges, a capacity to refresh, to be connected to the springs of life, to bring a sense of blessing into the world, no matter how alien that world may be. So maybe that's a good place just to stop. I really enjoyed talking with you. I would so wish we were in a room together. It is a kind of, it's like, would feel your presence more strongly. And sort of, but it's been very nice to have this opportunity. And I certainly look forward to the question and answer session we're going to have later on. Thank you very much.